Good morning, everybody. This is a podcast sponsorship. Nobody skips ahead. Nobody loses their head. Let's see who wins a prize for keeping their cool. The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Every coffee lover knows that the difference between a good cup of coffee and the best cup of coffee is freshly roasted beans. But unfortunately, even with a gun to their head, the clerks at your local grocery store or coffee shop probably couldn't tell you when the coffee they're selling you was roasted. Which is why you need Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans, directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer lots of blends and roasts to choose from, including decaf and half-calf. But best of all, Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home or office within a week of being custom roasted here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers autopilot, set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. So, Simon says, go to sparkplugcoffee.com right now. And hey, throw in a couple of bottles of Wild Turkey while you're at it.
You're a real live outlaw, aren't you?
Well, I may be an outlaw, darling, but you're the one stealing my heart.
Oh, yeehaw.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, everybody, and most gracious thanks for downloading the next 100 Project as we flit around the movie landscape to review whatever we find interesting, and it seems to be lately a lot of 90s movies, including today. If spoilers make you want to drive off a cliff, then perhaps you shouldn't keep listening to us. My CB handle is Breaker19, Ryan Ellis, and here's my partner in Arkansas-based crime, my wife Bev.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Thelma and Louise, Ridley Scott, Harvey Keitel, Kelly Khoury, and Adrian Biddle, the last two were the writer and cinematographer of this picture, shared a similar first in 1991. What was that first?
All of them were nominated for their first Academy Award that
year. Well done, but not just for this picture, so there was a bit of a trick question.
No, yeah. There. Harvey Keitel was nominated for Bugsy. Mm-hmm. And the only one to win was the writer, Kelly Khoury.
That's right. Scott had never been nominated despite doing Blade Runner and Alien even before that. Keitel and Khoury, their only nominations ever, was in 1991. Of course, Khoury did win, and then Biddle with his first in 91, and of course, Scott's had many since. So well done, my wife. Okay, the next 100 Project's 19th movie, Thelma and Louise, was liked enough by the AFI to be nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists, but of course, didn't make it. After screening at Cannes in May 1991, MGM tossed a flick out there for audiences later that month, and that makes this basically the 25th anniversary. Maybe we're a few weeks late, but 25 years ago, TNL came to the public. And the masses approved, helping the movie gross nearly three times its budget. But Bet, for those who aren't familiar with this movie that is 25 years old, please remind them now what it's about with the skinny.
Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon are the title characters. They go on a weekend road trip that quickly goes sideways when Louise shoots Thelma's would-be rapist in a roadhouse parking lot for giving her lip. And the two women go on the run. Harvey Keitel is the cop on their tail who tries to talk the women into turning themselves in before things get really out of hand.
Or, in a nutshell, what a shitty way to see the Grand Canyon.
I don't know. It's probably a great view, short-lived though it may be.
Still pretty shitty. All right, the Rotten Tomatoes critics, 83% of them liked it, 54 fresh, 11 rotten, and 82% of audiences, so almost exactly in line. The movie was 28th at the 1991 U.S. box office, Terminator 2 was number 1, and Silence of the Lambs, the Academy Award winner of that year, was number 4. 1991 was the year of strong women. You've got Silence of the Lambs, obviously Jodie Foster in that one, Terminator 2 with Linda Hamilton, Beauty and the Beast even, the animated film, nominated for Best Picture, Sleeping with the Enemy, Julia Roberts takes control of her own destiny and avoids being killed by her husband, and then, of course, Thelma and Louise.
Yeah.
Every year, one of the Academy Award winners will say, it was a great year for women at the movies, and a lot of times they're full of shit, but this year they were correct. What'd you think of Thelma and Louise, Bev?
Well, what's not to love about Thelma and Louise? Even if you take away the politics of women standing up to the creeps in their lives or the catharsis of watching a movie with two strong, interesting female leads, it's still just a plain, great film. It's like Butch and Sundance without the pacing problems.
You thought that had pacing problems, Butch and Sundance?
Well, Butch and Sundance has like a big lull in the middle. I still liked it plenty, but I think Thelma and Louise is just technically a really well-made film, and one of the things that Scott does well almost all the time is pacing. He keeps things going really well. Considering it's more than 2 hours long, right? It never feels long at all.
And that's one of the influences from another picture on this film, Butch and Sundance, for sure. Right down to the freeze frame ending where they commit suicide. Hey, spoiler alert, but we already told you we're going to spoil the movie.
I feel like I'll bring up Butch and Sundance a lot because there is a ton of similarities. And I also will say that a lot of the criticisms that Thelma and Louise faced are total bullshit because Butch and Sundance never face those same criticisms, even though it's guilty of the exact same things.
Because they're men. This is also the rare film that Ridley Scott directed that had any kind of comedy. Probably more of a charming kind of touch than actual comedy in the film. But it does get funny later on, even though it's funny that, well, funny is the wrong word, I guess, but ironic, I guess, that Thelma goes from being raped in one day and then has the best sexual experience of her entire life the very next day with Brad Pitt. It seems to be one day space between the attempted rape and then the thing with Pitt.
Agreed. Her character is kind of Teflon anyway, that she seems unaffected by all the things happening to her. Her husband is this total oaf. I mean, you talk about comedy. Christopher McDonald plays Daryl, and he's hilarious all the way through from the beginning to the end of this film. I'm kind of glad that they just made him a ridiculous comedic villain rather than having a cliche, evil, overbearing husband. And she never seems to take any of his silliness seriously. It never seems to like really permeate and get into her heart the way whatever Louise has been through has obviously affected her. She's suffering, I would say, from some form of PTSD, which is what led her to commit the crime of killing Harlan in the first place. But Thelma's character seems to be bulletproof. She's impervious, which is how she can suffer trauma one day and then have the best sex of her life the very next day.
Daryl may be mentally abusive, but not physically abusive. Not that mentally abusive is okay, but if he's just a neglectful husband and an oaf, then that's one thing. And of course, who knows where that can go, right? People can be that kind of way in a marriage, and they can be incredibly harmful, and others can be more physically intimidating, but not actually violent. It depends on the woman, and obviously Thelma, you're right, that's the right word for it, bulletproof. She's the one with the arc in this film.
Mm-hmm.
As well as Susan Sarandon plays the character in this film, it's obviously Gina Davis who has the I'm going to change arc from point A to point Z at the end of the film.
Yeah, when she escapes the tyranny of her marriage, of all the expectations that are placed on her and her life back home in Arkansas, she grows and blossoms into this crazy adventurer, and she so completely owns that. Like, there's a line in the movie where she says, oh, I think I finally found my calling. Mm-hmm. It's the call of the wild. And that's a perfect way to sum it up. She's just having so much fun, and she brings joy to everything. She's so silly and charming, and you can see how even though she's kind of a fuck up, she's so endearing and lovable that Louise isn't just going to forgive her, but she's going to try to protect her from herself.
And in fact, it works better that Louise is older than Thelma, while Sarandon is older than Gina Davis. Although the original script had them at about the same age.
But they're about 10 years apart.
I would say so. And then you got the mother-daughter thing that does play out well in the end where you've got the police, Radio Louise, which is in the trailer. I always remember that from the trailer more than the movie itself, really. Where Thelma's the one who's in charge when she takes over the whole cop. Jason Begay or Big, I forget how you pronounce his name. He was in that Going Clear documentary. He's a former Scientologist, and he likes to spill the beans as he does in that documentary. But I love his performance. He's in the movie for maybe 3 minutes. He goes from being the tough-ass cop with the mirrored sunglasses to, I got a wife and kid at the home. And he gets put in the trunk, and of course then you get the Rastafarian, and he comes along at the end and blows smoke into that trunk on him. So a very small performance, but a big performance in a small amount of screen time at least. But let's jump around, as we always do in these podcasts, and get back to the rape.
The inciting incident.
Well, the almost rape, at least. It's bad enough what happens. He should be at least charged with what he tries to do to Thelma. When Louise shoots him, nobody witnesses it. There's no evidence. Okay, the movie actually is pretty smart about how they put together logically, it must have been the two of them that shot this guy. In actual court cases, we think about OJ, for example, and all the evidence that seemed to be against him, and then he got off. And I've said many times he probably should have got off, and that wasn't that long after this movie came out, ironically. The women should have no reason to think they're being pursued, because where is the proof that they shot anybody?
I guess there were witnesses that saw him leave with Thelma.
Okay, let me lead this off then, because let's get into the feminist side of this thing.
Sure.
This isn't even feminist, this is humanist. This movie was controversial in 91, and it's still controversial for a lot of assholes in 2016. But she can dance with a guy, she can flirt with a guy, he can't expect sex. In 91, that was way more of a, well, you brought it on yourself. And it is pretty smart on Callie Curie's part to throw that in there from a line that Louise has. She doesn't say, what happened to us is your fault, Thelma. But she implies it. And then Thelma, for probably the first time, gets back at her a little bit. And maybe that's when she starts to grow as a person, saying, this is my fault. I almost got raped by this guy. In 91, that was more of a controversy. That shouldn't be a controversy then or now. It certainly is more reasonable to say, no, Harlan's the bad guy. Should he have been murdered for it? Okay, probably not murdered, but you can understand where that went.
It's still a controversy now. There are still court cases right now where women are persistently blamed for their own assaults or have their history of behavior used against them to imply that they're liars or exaggerators or they're just out to get their perpetrator. We're Canadian, so a great example that's currently in the news even today is Gian Gomeshi. Ryan's making such a fist. He's not a popular man in this house. He's kind of like the Canadian Bill Cosby, and he was actually brought up on criminal charges for his behavior, but the women who accused him were raked over the coals, and every little thing that they did was held up for the court to judge, and in the end, it was determined they didn't have enough evidence to prosecute him. So this still happens today, and when Louise says to Thelma, who's gonna believe you? You were dancing with him all night, you were drunk. She's right, and she knows this for a fact, because when she alludes to what happened to her back in Texas, which comes up several times, they're very good about this, they don't overdo it, but they imply that she has some trauma from back when she lived in Texas, and of course we can understand that she was raped, that she tried to prosecute her rapist, and that she was the one who was forced to defend herself for her actions that led to her own assault. The guy probably got off. And she's never...
Oh, I think it's for sure they got... They don't right. make it clear. Isn't it curious, too, that Thelma seems to guess what happened, but doesn't know what happened? But Harvey Keitel, the sympathetic cop, the only guy in this movie who's really, truly an innocent man in the film, and that's one of the things he was criticized for. We'll get to that in a second. He actually knows what happened to her because he has the police files. And it's also curious that the protagonist and the antagonists, I guess, because they are the bad guys, effectively, although they are... We're going to get to this later, but the heroes and villains list, they're on the hero side. But they're criminals in the usual sense of the word. They never meet face to face. It's only over on the phone, and at the very end of the film, they're in the same area, but not face to face. He's sympathetic to the fact you were raped, and he knows that, and that almost breaks her down. But Thelma never fully 100% knows that's what happened to her best friend.
Yeah, she's just sensitive enough not to force her to give her the details, but Harvey Keitel has the advantage of just being able to make a phone call and find out exactly what happened to her in Texas. They know who she is, they know that she pressed these charges and had to testify against her perpetrator. Now, that being said, and while she may be suffering from PTSD, the movie is pretty explicitly clear that Harlan's a bad guy, and he would have raped Thelma if he could have gotten away with it, but he had stopped. The rape had been thwarted. He was just at this point being mouthy. Louise shot him because she was mad. It was like second-degree murder. She committed murder. It's not ambiguous at all. Of course, they go to some lengths to make us believe that Harlan was a bad guy who, I don't want to say deserved to die, but, well, yeah, they basically imply that he deserved to die. The only person who speaks about him is the waitress, who, for the record, is the only other woman with a speaking part in this whole film other than Thelma and Louise.
Mm-hmm. And she's with them. She's on their side. She knows what Harlan's like. He probably goes to that same roadhouse every night.
Yeah.
Does the same thing. Maybe not raping women, but looking for women to play
and
with.
Actually,
and
like
even admits in his little attempted rape before, I'm married too, darling.
Mm-hmm.
So not only is he an attempted rapist, but he's cheating on his wife.
Yeah, and the waitress says, I don't know who shot him. I hope it was his wife. She knows he's a bad dude, and they have to include that scene so that the audience can always stay on Louise's side because she committed a heinous crime. She should spend the rest of her life in prison for what she did.
Okay, well, the controversy about the film is more so, I think, that apart from Keitel, all the men in this film are assholes. Even Brad Pitt steals from them. Is it cartoonishly anti-male? Maybe. But I think us guys, especially us white guys, can take the heat.
There's a couple of cartoonish villains, and maybe you could include Harlan in that, the rapist. And you could definitely include Daryl in that.
Very cartoonish.
The husband of ridiculous villain. But you look at characters like JD, who's Brad Pitt's character, Michael Madsen's character, Jimmy. They are, I guess you could say, bad guys, but they are complex, fully realized characters who do good things and bad things just like any normal human. They have more depth than most women in most Hollywood films,
period. Well, that's true, and Michael Madsen has very little screen time, and apart from throwing stuff off a table in a hotel room, when he's upset that his girlfriend is leaving forever and not telling him why, it isn't cool, but I understand why he would do it. And in the end, it seems like Louise forgives him because he's an impetuous kind of guy. I don't know what I would do if you told me, well, we're married, it's different than just boyfriend, girlfriend, but I don't know what I would do if you were to say you're going to leave me forever and not tell me why. I'd probably want to throw something too.
I felt like the audience was meant to forgive him for being angry that she was leaving him. It's because he loves her. So why wouldn't we find that an honest and endearing thing to do? He loses his temper, but he doesn't do anything unforgivable. Actually, the one thing he does that's unforgivable is when he gets home to Arkansas and the cops are at his door.
And he says he's not going to rat her out, but he does.
He rats her out. He sold her down the river. That's the worst thing he does. He has so much depth. He's a real three-dimensional character. And there is at least three men with speaking parts in this film for every woman. So men claiming that this is unfair is being babies. Give me a break. If you were to compare this to every other film in Hollywood and how the women are treated, throw it in the lump of characters and how they're treated, be they women or men. This doesn't begin to even out the score.
Yes, and this has been deliberately anti-male. First of all, you got a male director and a female writer. That kind of balances out right there. The woman who originated the screenplay, let's say she's trying to make all guys look like assholes, but then they've got this powerful director who is at the helm of this thing, so he can temper that. And maybe he did temper that. We don't know what was in the original screenplay. Maybe Scott actually brought it back from being even more silly. But even if it had been, let them have one. I'm saying let them as a guy. I'm sitting beside a woman, but let them have one movie. But let me say this other thing about the male thing, on the other hand, though, too, is that Scott does this thing where there's constant phallic symbols in the film. The big trucks that go by them all the time. The trains. Male machinery. Not that machinery has to be male. Or the crop duster. All these kinds of things that are men coming at you. Not that they're trying to hurt these women. But then the guy driving the truck, of course, does. That really cartoonishly truck driver.
And in the southern United States, you don't have to look very far to find symbols of machismo and the patriarchy in general. It's a pretty macho part of the world.
But also about the controversy, though. The women are given all this credit of being wonderful bastions of awesomeness, and the men are assholes. But it's ironic because people always want to say they're root for the underdog. These two women are the ultimate underdogs.
Yeah, they're also a murderer and an armed robber. They're not bastions. People also complained that it was a bad influence. Oh, this movie is giving women the idea they should turn to a life of crime to fight the patriarchy. No, it's a movie about these people. If there were more movies about strong, fully realized women characters, maybe you wouldn't take this one and try to use it as an example for everything. Like, we're all supposed to take this as our role model for behavior. No, Kali Khoury said explicitly, she wasn't trying to write a feminist manifesto. She just wanted to tell a good story with strong female characters. But, of course, the landscape for female characters in Hollywood was and is so bleak that simply writing complex, strong, leading roles for women, unfortunately, becomes a political act. And it's such a ridiculous accusation that this movie was bad role models for women, because it's a standard that never would have been applied to Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid.
Yeah, and anytime movies go against the grain and have these characters, they're trying to fight back against the system. Butch and Sundance have been robbers for as long as the movie's on, obviously, and many years before that. Just because they want to be. It's all they're really good at. They have other options. They could do other things. We love them. I really love them. It's one of my favorite movies, one of my favorite westerns, one of my favorite comedies. But they've got no excuse. These two people are backed into a corner. Louise does the wrong thing. Okay, but I can understand why she did the wrong thing. They don't have any other options, realistically speaking, at least, especially back in, I guess it's supposed to be set in 1991 or 1990 when they would have shot the film. When we compare those two pictures, even though I prefer the other one because it is funnier, the women have way more reason to be doing what they're doing, even right down to the stealing from the variety store. Not that it's cool that Thelma does it, but you can understand why she does it.
Yeah, one of the things that the script does really well is each action seems to be an absolute reaction to things that happened previously in the film. The way the plot carries on feels really authentic and realistic, believable.
I love that Thelma paid so much attention to JD's speech that she actually has it down almost word for word when she does it. Now, for car aficionados, they are driving a 1966 Ford Thunderbird that drives off into the Grand Canyon. And they shot the movie in Utah and California, but it's set, of course, in Arkansas and Oklahoma, and I guess they end up in Arizona when they get to the Grand Canyon. Hollywood loves a road movie, but they hate the cost and logistics of shooting one. So it's almost surprising. Maybe it's Ridley Scott, Susan Sarandon, and even Gina Davis at that point. She had won the Oscar for The Accidental Tourist, a supporting actress Oscar, a few years before. Maybe that's why they got the budget that they did get to shoot this movie, because you go on the road like that, it's, oh, we can't do that, and you've got women who are shooting and killing people, doing all these terrible things. How can they do that? Oh.
Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis probably helped get this film made, but you're talking about two actresses who were 35 and 45, and typically that's not something that Hollywood execs flip the green light on for.
Yeah, I'd say Meryl Streep's the only actress in Hollywood, certainly in the modern era, who can get a film greenlit, despite being of a certain age. Sarandon is behind her on that totem pole, probably can't get a movie greenlit. We've barely seen Gina Davis in the last 15 or 20 years. She's made mostly TV since the early 2000s.
Speaking of middle-aged women that can get films greenlit, I bet that Melissa McCarthy can get a film greenlit.
Okay. Yeah, comedy. Mm-hmm. They will let somebody who is supposed to be the silly comedy person, because let's face it, they're going to pigeonhole people in a lot of different ways, and that's one of them.
Oh, yeah.
And Sarandon, for the most part, has done dramas, but she's also done comedies, and so has Gina Davis. She's done both. McCarthy's not going to be thought of in the great dramatic roles.
No, and even as we talk about Gina Davis, who I think is a fabulous actress, she must be as good as the team that's working with her, because she's definitely had some crummy performances to go with her great performances.
Although, ironically, the very next year, she was in one of my favorite movies, certainly one of her best performances, A League of Their Own. Didn't get nominated for the Oscar, neither did Tom Hanks, even though they're both great in that film. One of the great baseball movies of all time, and a very feminist film.
But whatever reasons you want to give for it, her career has more or less kind of dried up, gone the way of actresses reaching a certain age, and the roles stop coming to her. And yeah, it's not like she's done nothing, but she's more or less in TV now, and you don't really see her in the box office at all anymore.
It's possible that as a mother, for one thing, she wants to be home more. And when you do TV, the cliche is that you can be home at 6 o'clock at night with your kids, and you can have a normal life more than you can with the movie shoot.
Okay, but she's pushing 60 now, so she can't.
Well, I'm talking when this started back in around 2000, when she had the Gina Davis show, and she did some other things. That was a Commander-in-Chief she did,
yes,
as
that's
well.
Right. That's what I'm,
and that may have been the logic of that. Although those kinds of film-like TV shows, maybe you actually don't get a 9-to-5 type of day. But that is the stereotype of TV shows, and one reason why a lot of people like to stick with that genre, whether they can break into films or not. They want to just do a thing where they can just go home at the end of the day. Hey, if I ever got into movies, I never will. I'd rather do a 9-to-5 kind of schedule myself if I could.
Sure, but if you're talking about a movie star's career trajectory, it's probably a pretty generous notion to suggest they made the choice to step away from the spotlight when they were approaching middle age for an actress. I'm sure that lots of them say that, and I'm sure that for many people that's true, but there's probably just as many actresses who would have loved to remain movie stars who just weren't given the opportunity.
But how about Sarandon? She's one of the greats of all time. She's 70. Oh, 70 in October. She's been in the business for 46 years, and there's no signs of retiring. She's even got a movie out right around now. What's it called?
The Meddler.
Right, that's in theaters as we record this podcast. Well, we hope so. It's a few weeks
getting great reviews
before. Okay, there you go. So it's probably still in theaters. And if it isn't, then you can see it on demand or Netflix or something in a few months. It's also curious that Sarandon's character in the beginning of the film works in a diner. Then the plot happens because of what happens in a roadhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And they should have just gone fishing. That was my original nutshell, by the way. They should have just gone fishing, because they do put in the back of the car fishing rods. Can you see these two characters fishing, especially the early Thelma?
No.
Who's dressed so prettily and so prissily and so nice. Not a fisherman. But
both
they should have just gone
prissily.
Right, they should have just gone to the lodge and fished. But then again, I'm doing the thing that guys do. They have a right to drink, and they have a right to have a little bit of fun, and then say, I don't want to fuck you, leave me alone.
Yeah. People are always telling women they want to stay safe, they should not go to parties, that they should not drink at these parties, that they shouldn't put themselves in positions where they could be in danger. But you know what? There's a reason why men like to tie one on to blow off steam. Women like to do that too, and to deprive women of that right to just have fun is, in a way, a little oppression. We get fed up with it, and we break the rules because we're human.
Okay, so feminism, let's get back to the choices that women make with their boyfriends, one longer term, the one very short term. Sarandon's choice of Michael Madsen. I do regret my marriage proposal after seeing the master of romance, Jimmy, in this film do it. Here, here's a ring for you. Let's marry me.
Well, she sees right through it. She knows that He just wants her because she's running away.
Isn't that almost one of the more romantic ways to do it, though? It's, I don't want to lose you, so I will do what I think you want. I don't get women. I don't get people. Probably we don't know enough about Jimmy to know what he's really like. He's trying the best he can.
You're asking me if that's romantic?
Okay, maybe not romantic, but there's something about that that's noble, I suppose. He goes all the way there with the money to try to stop her from leaving, but he doesn't understand her, obviously.
No.
He's not a very bright person. He's just a dumb musician.
It's not detestable. Neither is it romantic. And I think even you can admit she would have been making a huge mistake to say yes to his proposal.
Well, even if he had done that when everything was fine, had there not been a murder that was committed on a weekend trip. Yes, but I do admire that he's doing the best he can, and he doesn't understand this. He is kind of a Cro-Magnon sort of guy, and he just is trying to get by with somebody who's way above him. Michael Madsen is going after the older ladies in this film. Well, the character, not him, of course. I think Sorin's got about 10 years on Madsen.
Is that right?
You don't see that in a lot of movies, unless it's a deliberate plot point where a woman's supposed to be older than the guy.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you got J.D., Thelma is pretty dumb about JD, but then horniness betrays remote common sense.
How many husbands and boyfriends have Brad Pitt's performance to thank for some amazing spontaneous sex? Because god damn, you can't even stay mad at him after he's robbed them. You just gotta watch him leave.
Well, we just covered him 2 weeks ago. We've done two straight Brad Pitt movies with a week off in between for Victoria Day. But this was his big breakout. George Clooney auditioned for it over and over again. And when you see Pitt shirtless, you can see why.
Yes.
He's a Mexican hairless. So, you know what's good about that, though? I bring it up to make a laugh, but also because you've got this guy who's obviously very masculine, great-looking dude, but also he's got this boyish, perfect, chiseled figure. Actually, perfect. He got better-looking as he got older, maybe. Certainly by the time he was about 50, he might have been more attractive than he is even at this point in 1991. Had Clooney been in the role, he might have been more intimidating. Pitt's character is so boyish and so trustworthy, I guess. Why wouldn't she trust him once she leaves room with the money there and he's in the shower?
And something that's exceptional that Ridley Scott really deserves credit for, while both Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon are really attractive women, you never feel like the male gaze is turned on them. You never really feel like their looks are something that are meant to be on display in this movie. And yet, the opposite is true for Brad Pitt. That camera is meant to just make him look sexy. It is meant to titillate the women in the audience, and that is something that is beyond sexy and something that we appreciate. It's something that's practically cathartic because we see so little of it in Hollywood, especially in 1991.
And then, as we said, on 7, he went on to do California, where he's not very attractive, and he's a bad guy. Legends of the Fall, where he's a heroic character and very sexy. Interview with the Vampire, also sexy-ish. A little white, a little gothic.
A little emo.
Right. But then, of course, 7, 12 Monkeys, and the great career he had after that. Actually, somebody made a point, I think it may have been Roger Ebert, and Meet Joe Black in 1998, where when he has sex with Claire Forlani's character, he plays Death. You focus on his face when he's having the orgasm because Death doesn't understand this. Whoa, whoa. But usually in sex in Hollywood movies, it's about the woman's orgasm because, of course, that's what has to happen. Of course, she'll come when any guy is fucking her, but especially a Brad Pitt, George Clooney, or Christian Slater, who almost had this role. And as much as I'm not a Christian Slater fan in general, at this point in his career, would have been a good choice.
Yeah.
But when you cast Brad Pitt, who was not very well known at that point, he'd done Cool World, I think, the same year, you get lucky with that. That's also this, who is this guy?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have had, but I won't do it this week, the reasonably good questions. I will ask this one, just as a standalone reasonably good question. Are gas stations in rural Arkansas really the best places for grifters to wait for victims?
What are you talking about?
When they come across him by himself at a gas station. They first see him, I'm sorry to waste your time, ma'am, and he walks away. But then later on their trip, he's at another gas station down the road. There's nothing else there. There's nobody else there.
It's not even an intersection.
So, is that really a great way to grift people, which is obviously his whole MO?
But he's not trying to grift them. I think he really did like Thelma and really was romancing her and then discovered that she had nearly $7,000 on her nightstand and robbed her. Had he not seen that, I don't think he would have stolen whatever she did have.
So, you see, you're trusting him now, too.
You're falling into their JD trap. I'm saying it was a crime of opportunity.
Okay, maybe fair enough. That's why I only have that and no other reasonably good questions. Okay, so the ending. Just before it, Thelma has a line I really like from this film. Three words. I feel awake. And there's a reason why I like that line so much in the year 2016, because it's a quote you've mentioned many times. People say they're woke to racial issues or sexist issues or whatever the issue might be. But in this film, it's about how it's not that I'm awake and I'm not tired. It's that I'm awakened to what is going on in the world, to myself, to you as my friend, to what I'm going to do, what I hope to do, and what I wish I hadn't done before.
Yeah, one of the best things the movie does is it really conveys this beautiful, glorious sense of freedom. They have left literally everything behind, and they're starting from scratch, and they couldn't be happier about it. And it's infectious. It's such a great feeling.
But then at the end, you get the freeze frame ending, just like in Butch and Sundance. Had you kept the shot going, and the car goes into the Grand Canyon and all the way down, and maybe don't show it actually crash, but it's at the peak when they fade to white, and then it's the recap. We see all what happened in the film. Had you kept it going, it'd be very sad, of course. The studio didn't like the ending, but the movie might have just come and gone had it ended any differently than that. Had they just given up to Harvey Keitel, or had they had the shot where they go down and, oh my god, the car obliterates and you see body parts everywhere.
I disagree. Okay, I think that that was the proper ending for the film. But had they really chickened out and let them either get arrested or get to Mexico, I still think this would be a well-regarded film that people still cared about today, because it's an excellent movie apart from this controversial and incredibly powerful ending.
Women are choosing their own fate, just like in Butch and Sundance. At the end, they know they're going to die. Do you see LaFour's out there? No. Oh, good. For a moment there, we thought we were in trouble. That's the last line of the film. They walk out, and of course, they get gunned down by dozens and dozens of Bolivian guns.
There's a significant difference, which is that in Butch and Sundance, they were probably going to die no matter what they did. Whereas with Thelma and Louise, they truly had an option. They could have just put their hands up, gone to prison, which probably wouldn't have even been the worst of all fates for them. They're pretty tough broads. They probably could have done all right in prison. But they choose to die. They would rather die. They would rather just go out.
On their terms.
Yeah. Roger Ebert criticized the film. Well, he loved the film, but he gave it 3.5 stars instead of his top 4. And he said that that half star was missing because he felt that Ridley Scott rushed the ending and chickened out by including that montage at the end, by just kind of not lingering on the moment of their suicide and really letting the audience have it sink in.
As we're talking about Ridley Scott here, he's had a lot of dark or unhappy endings in this film. Some of his most famous ones, in fact. Alien, Sigourney Weaver's character gets away, but all of her friends are dead, and then there's an alternate ending where actually the alien does kill her in that spacecraft. But in the ending we know in the film, she survived, but barely. Blade Runner, Harrison Ford's character survives all this stuff. He's done his job, but whether you want to believe he's a replicant or not, he's on the run with another replicant. Gladiator, Russell Crowe's character, is dead at the end of the film. Everyone's seen Gladiator. I'm not going to give that one away, I don't think, at this point. And there's a lot of other films you can mention from this guy's oeuvre, I'm sure, that go into the same kind of territory of, I'm going to die on my terms, or, regardless, this movie's not going to end in a nice little package and happy ending.
I mean, obviously, the most easy happy ending would have been that they get to Mexico. In your opinion, the ending being what it is, would you consider it a happy or a sad ending?
Dying on your own terms is always happy-ish, because again, we talked about Butch and Sundance, and they chose the way they went out. They went out wisecracking, actually, and of course the characters in Thelma and Louise don't do that. They're sincere. You know what's weird? I'm thinking right now as we talk about this going on your own way, I'm thinking if you got cancer. The actor Richard Farnsworth, the guy from The Straight Story, he was in so many other movies before that. He got cancer right after he did The Straight Story, as I recall, blew his own head off with a shotgun.
So did Hunter S. Thompson.
Right, because they wanted to go on their own terms. I guess you have to respect that, that they're saying, fuck the world and fuck nature, I want to die the way I want to die. And that's what Thelma and Louise do.
But they weren't dying.
Well, in their eyes, prison. They would have been. They couldn't have faced prison, that's the idea. I couldn't go back, as Thelma says. And I think she might as well be including prison in that and going back to the way things were, the man's way, the authoritarian way.
And you know it had to be Thelma to make that suggestion at the end, because Louise never would have asked that of Thelma. But Thelma was the spontaneous one. She is the one that would even think of that. But Louise never would have let Thelma kill herself if she didn't think it was her idea.
If I'm a good lawyer, Thelma's got to do time for armed robbery. They have her on tape. It's obvious. There's witnesses. But Louise, you cannot prove she shot Harlan if she doesn't admit to it.
Okay, but we, the audience, know that she committed second-degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not debatable.
In the space of lawyerdom, Okay. No, she gets off.
Well, if
on
she
that
could
charge.
Get Johnny Cochran to defend.
So
her
maybe that's actually more heroic for Louise that she sticks with her friend when she probably has to really mull this over and say, what have they got me on? Nothing. They've got my friend on armed robbery. But I'm going to go down with the ship with her because she doesn't want to go down. She wants to get away from this life she had that she hated.
And hell, it's Thelma's gun, too.
Mm-hmm.
The That's same right. gun that Thelma used to hold up that
And Thelma's
gasoline.
Fingerprints are also on the cars. They do build it up. I remember I said to you after she gets raped, how do they have anything on them? But they do layer in a few other little things about how there's the gun, the fingerprints, but that's still circumstantial because there's no witness and there's no weapon. They can get rid of the gun very easily. And if you don't have those things, OJ. How funny I bring that up yet again. Okay, so the actresses. Nearly every actress in Hollywood were discussed for these two roles. The two I like the most, Michelle Pfeiffer and Jodie Foster. Well, apart from Sarandon and Davis, because they were great. Pfeiffer and Foster would have been a great combination, I think. Kelly Currie wanted Holly Hunter and Frances McDormand, the old Coen brothers'
yeah.
friends. And half of the IMDb trivia is about who could have directed the movie or starred in it. So if you want to read that, then be prepared to read an awful lot of, it could have been this person, or this person, or this person.
Well, kudos for the choices they made, because they made an excellent film in the end. Everything, all the pieces really did come together.
And if I can say again about how you got the mother-daughter relationship early on, with Sarandon being older than Davis, Pfeiffer and Foster are about the same age, and they seem about the same. Pfeiffer had been in Jonathan Demme's previous movie, Married to the Mob, and was so good in that. And then Foster was in the same year, Silence of the Lambs, the Oscar winner for Best Actress, yes. against these two,
yes.
Davis and Sarandon, who probably split the vote. Foster would have seemed maybe the more younger one of the two between her and Pfeiffer, but then you lose that dynamic if you cast those two. All right, Harvey Keitel, nearly 50 years in the business, and he's still working an awful lot. Probably his most sympathetic role in this movie, I would say. And as we said, the same year he gets nominated for Bugsy for Best Supporting Actor. But of course, we covered him on the Top Gunner project in Taxi Driver and Pulp Fiction, where he's not so sympathetic, although Pulp Fiction, I guess he's in the criminal world, pretty sympathetic as the Wolf. What did you think of his performance? Because he is the third lead of the film, really.
Well, like Madsen or Brad Pitt as JD, you have another character who's not a massive character in the film. It doesn't take up a lot of space, but who still has depth and a real personality.
He's a good cop, too. He's fair as well. We've talked about all the actors now, except for one I gotta mention, one of the supporting guys, and we covered him already in Groundhog Day, Stephen Tobolowsky,
yes.
Needle Nose Ned in that film. And this one, he is Keitel's, I guess actually maybe his boss, because at the end, he's the one who's saying, I'm let you come, Hal. As if
Isn't
he's
it
got.
That he's the Fed and Keitel's the local?
He's the Arkansas cop.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Right. But I bring him up because, for one thing, it's a pretty good performance, but also he's always eating.
Yes.
And we know Brad Pitt in movies. Not the ones we've covered, Thelma, Louise, and Seven, but so many times is eating in movies, where here it's Stephen Tobolowsky, who's always eating or drinking something.
I feel like eating in a scene is kind of a power move. It's kind of like a macho thing to do when you're having a conversation with someone else and you're just eating through it like you don't give a fuck. Even though he's not an aggressively macho guy who's taking control of every situation, although when it comes down to it, he does remind Keitel, listen, I'm the boss here. I'm the one in charge, and you're here by my good graces. And they certainly all treat Daryl like a total afterthought, which is part of the comedy.
You're standing in your pizza, sir.
He gets the best laughs in the movie. He's so good.
I read that some of the mistakes in the film actually worked out quite well, too, because when he slips on the wood in the beginning with the construction guys, that he actually wasn't supposed to slip on the wood, but then he just went with it, and they said, get out of here by 3 o'clock. And that was a little improv that worked. Also, the improv, Louise is calling for Thelma, and Gina Davis didn't actually hear Susan Sarandon because she's got headphones on, so Sarandon gets out of the car and comes across to her and grabs her, and Davis, ah! Apparently that was actually Gina Davis not hearing Susan Sarandon calling for her, so they just went with the scene. But when you see little moments like that and you read about them, think, that actually works really well. And I notice it more when I hear that those moments weren't in the screenplay, because of course you want to hear that actors and actresses can play scenes the way they're written, but when they can come up with something that's just an accident, Robert Altman always said the best things in movies are accidents. Maybe not the best things in this movie, but some of the better things are the unintentional moments.
And when you have great actors, they can embody their characters so much that they create some of the most sincere moments in films.
Mm.
So before we move on from the actors, I just want to compliment Davis and Sarandon. Maybe part of the reason that they got cast is because they have an incredible chemistry and rapport with one another, and that's another thing Hollywood rarely gets right is female friendships. And that authenticity is not just something that makes the film work, but it's something that, as a woman who experiences female friendships and rarely gets to see them portrayed in movies, it's like cathartic to see something like that on film portrayed this well with this much heart and authenticity.
Obviously, Davis and Pitt have great chemistry. Mm-hmm. They look great together. Mm-hmm. Davis was in her physical prime. She was gorgeous. He was gorgeous. Although, as I said before, I think he gets even better looking as he gets a little older. But yeah, the two women in the movie have to spend so much time together, and they are a great combination.
And Scott really lets us spend time with Thelma and Louise. We see them at their best and their worst, and sometimes we just see them take a breath and watch them quietly drive. It's to his credit that these moments are never dull, and they blend perfectly with the pace of the story.
I read that Sarandon was worried that the scenic shots were going to overtake the movie, and they didn't think they'd actually be in it that much. It'd be a lot of voiceover and that kind of stuff, which he doesn't use, I don't think, at all, does he?
No.
But there are a lot of scenic shots, and of course you get into the Badlands, get the Old West look. And it's so unusual for Ridley Scott, especially at that point in his career. He's prolific, he works all the time. He just did The Martian just last year.
Yeah.
He's 79 in November. Amazing. He's like Lamette and Eastwood, he's still making movies at a prolific rate, does not stop making movies, despite the fact he's way past retirement age.
And The Martian was a great film! One of the best films he's made in years. I can't believe he's making work like that at the end of his career.
Mm-hmm. Also, you've got the Blade Runner level of rain in this film. We talked about this during Seven, which, of course, is a very rainy film. And he didn't direct that one, but he did direct this picture where you've got so much rain in Arkansas. It's almost always sunny when you've got the rain. So they've, of course, got the rain towers up above the actors just blasting down on them to give it atmosphere, I guess. The writer Callie Khoury, who won the Oscar for this film, she only wrote two other movie scripts, and then she created Nashville for TV, which I've never seen, although I love that movie so much.
It's not based on the movie whatsoever.
No, it really isn't. It's a
completely separate property.
No. And then the producers were Ridley Scott himself and Mimi Polk, who did four films with Scott. The movie's 2:35:1, as Ridley Scott always works in that ratio, or at least almost always, and we watched the DVD. It's fine, nothing wrong with it. Cinematographer, we already mentioned him, Adrian Biddle. His first two films ever were Aliens and The Princess Bride.
Jesus!
What a good start in your career.
No kidding.
And then you get this one, not that many years after Princess Bride, where you get the Oscar nomination.
Then he kind of made some dreck after that, though.
Well, Aliens, Princess Bride, and Thelma Louise is not a bad career, though.
No, fair.
The editor was Tom Noble, who won the Oscar 6 years before this for Witness, the Harrison Ford film. His first movie was Fahrenheit 451 for Francois Truffaut. Not a bad start for him. And the music, which we both liked, I know you did, yes. Hans Zimmer, Mr. Bombast in the modern era, at least with all the Christopher Nolan films. But this one was iconic, and he had done the Rain Man score 3 years before, an Oscar winner for Best Picture and so on. Kind of similar, actually. Both road movies. I think it's a terrific soundtrack in general. In fact, I downloaded Better Not Look Down, the B.B. King song, right after we watched this. But what about the score? You're a notorious disliker of bombastic scores, but this one's pretty good, right?
It is great. They don't overuse it. And actually, they don't use it all that much at all because they rely far more on existing songs that play in the soundtrack.
Part of Me, Part of You. Glenn Frey. That's the other one I downloaded not that long ago.
Okay.
Good song.
I'm not a country music person, so the songs are not particularly familiar to me.
I don't think the B.B. King song's country.
No, that's not.
All right, the influence. We talked about Butch and Sundance. The guys in Deliverance, and I saw that recently, go on a trip and rape ruins that good time, too.
Another
film, actual rape this time.
Yeah, another film that's like a lot about machismo. It's really about the male condition in a way that is critical in a different way.
And next year is the 45th anniversary of that picture. Maybe we should cover that one.
We definitely should cover that one. It's an excellent movie.
Tori Amos wrote a song about being raped after seeing this film.
Me and a Gun, which as a woman born in the late 70s, I had the obligatory year in college that I spent exclusively listening to Tori Amos, as a white woman especially. And that album is my favorite Tori Amos album, and that song is so intense and powerful that I have to skip it most of the time. When you hear the song, you know obviously this really happened to her and that she's not making this up. It's just really amazing.
Tip your hat to such a good song that you can't actually listen to the good song.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's kind of like Seven is a great film, but it's hard to watch. Well, Me and a Gun is a great song, but it's hard to listen to because it's simply too real.
The last influence for me is a very curious one, and we'll get away from that dark stuff into something comedic. Harold and Kumar go to White Castle. They have a similar arc to the character in Thelma Louise. They have abusive bullies. At the end, they have a cliff dive, but of course at the end they eat burgers, and they survive, so it's not quite the same, but some things are similar, And that actually gets us away from the rape of Tori Amos, and that's a good thing. So the awards and AFI list section. One Oscar for Kaley Cooery's screenplay, and the 5 failed nominations. Best director for Ridley Scott, the 2 actresses, Davis and Sarandon, who lost to Judy Foster, Noble's editing, and Biddle's cinematography. And interestingly, all 5 of the Oscar losses were to JFK and Silence of the Lambs. The 3 successful AFI lists it made, 78th on the top 100 Cheers, so you're inspired to kill yourself in the Grand Canyon. 76th on the top 100 Thrills, and 24th on the heroic side of the top 100 Heroes and Villains. And they're 2 of the few
women
teams, well, also women, teams of people on the hero side. And are they really heroes? They do commit bad acts, but we're with them. So it's what we've said so many times in movies like Pulp Fiction, Goodfellas, Godfather. You're with the bad guys, what should be bad guys, because they're committing crimes, because they're the characters you're being shown the whole time. Watch the movie from another point of view, and maybe you think Thelma and Louise belong in jail. And we're saying it now. Thelma belongs in jail for the armed robbery. Louise killed somebody. But are they really heroes?
They're the protagonists.
Right, and that's why we like them, and they also go out their own way, and that's what makes them heroic. I'm not disputing, I'm just saying that's an interesting choice, because Bonnie and Clyde are on the villain side of that same list.
Ha!
And in the end, they are, as criminals go, pretty decent people.
They're kind of tragic heroes, but they are murderers.
Bonnie and Clyde?
Yeah.
Yeah, more directly than
they kill innocent people.
Yeah. Okay, well, last thoughts on Thelma and Louise.
Thumbs way up. If this podcast puts you in the mood to revisit this movie, trust that instinct. You will not be disappointed. It has aged very well.
I like the film, too. We wouldn't have covered it if we both didn't like it. Okay, on June 6th, we'll have a movie that will be 30 years and 1 day old. It's a classic for people of our generation, especially mine, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Oh, yeah.
That movie's 30 years old.
Yeah.
That makes me feel so ancient.
Okay, the coming attraction trivia for Ferris Bueller's Day Off. John Hughes directed only 8 movies. None of them were sequels. He wrote a lot of theatrically released movies for other directors. How many of those were sequels?
All right, for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out the website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, rate us, review us. It helps other people find us. And while you're there, check out all of our other podcasts that are 100% available for you on iTunes. All the films that we've covered, which include all 123 films that ever made the AFI's Top 100 lists, either in 98 or 2007, along with now dozens of other titles that we've also covered for the project. And you can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. You can find Ryan and me on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, before we go, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com.
Okay, it's time to put some distance between us and the scene of our last goddamn crime.
And cut.